Money 105.5 presents Money 2.0.
Money 2.0.
Now, from Rogerson Business Services, certified business broker Andrew Rogerson on Money 2.0.
Good morning and welcome to 105.5 FM and Money 2.0. I'm the host of the show, Andrew Rogerson. I've got two guests this morning. My first guest will be Fred Hall, and my second guest is Lisa Miller. Fred is the owner of Affordable Business Valuations up in the Sierra foothills. And guess what? Fred specializes in doing business valuations, which is probably the reason why he calls himself Affordable Business Valuations. So I'll be talking to Fred about business valuations. And my second guest later on the show is Lisa Miller. And Lisa's the owner and CEO of Ladybug Pest Control. So I'll be talking to her about her franchise concept and what she does to help the people of the U.S. with pest control. So Lisa will be the second guest in the show. If you're listening and you're out driving and you hear the show and you want to go back and hear what we've said, you're welcome to visit my website. There's a copy of the show. Later this afternoon it will be available on my website, www.rogersonbusinessservices.com, and go to the black ribbon across the top. It says Media. Underneath that, there's a drop-down that says 105.5 FM and Money 2.0, and you can go there and you'll hear today's show, plus all the shows we've been doing since about February. So you're welcome to download the show and listen to it at your convenience. So what's this show about? This show is for business owners or those dreaming of becoming a business owner and are looking for more information, ready to take action. We cover topics that include the spectrum of selling a business or buying a business or buying a franchise. And these topics include finance, legal issues, tax, accounting, as well as sales and marketing. And again, we're going to be talking about business valuations today with Fred. So as I like to say, this show is where Wall Street meets Main Street. My name is Andrew Rogerson. I'm a certified business broker and the host of your show. I'm certified through the California Association of Business Brokers. I'm certified with the International Business Brokers Association. I'm also the author of four books, Successfully Buy Your Business, Successfully Start Your Business, Successfully Buy Your Franchise, and of course, Successfully Sell Your Business. Again, if you'd like to know more about buying a business or selling a business, you're welcome to visit my website, www.rogersonbusinessservices.com, or you're welcome to give me a call, 916-570-2674. Each week I touch on a community event, and if you're in the Elk Grove area on Friday, which is the day after the 4th of July, between 7 a.m. and 11 a.m., they're doing a park cleanup on the 4th of July. Obviously, there'll be a bunch of things happening down at Elk Grove. So if you've got some spare time on Friday morning between 7 a.m. and 11 a.m., they would love your help to clean up the park down there in Elk Grove. If you're in the Elk Grove area, want more information, give them a call, 916-447-7063. 916-447-7063. Each week I do a blog, and my blog this week was picking up something that I find interesting. The blog is called What Can a Business Owner Learn from Paula Deen and the Food Network? So if you're wondering what that's about, go to my blog, www.rogersonbusinessservices.com, and you'll see my blog. I've written about Paula Deen and the demise of her empire in rapid time, and there's some thoughts there about what she should be doing or should have done as a business owner to prevent that all happening. So my first guest, I've mentioned Fred Hall. He's just flown in from Hawaii. Fred's got his scuba diving certification, and I've known Fred for about seven or eight years, I guess.
Yeah.
And Fred specializes in doing business valuations. Fred, have I got you there?
You got me. That was great.
Thank you for being here this morning.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, that's great. Now, business valuations is an intriguing area. As a business broker, I get lots of requests for business valuations, and trying to break it down and explain it to people is intriguing. So, Fred, tell us how did you get to become a business appraiser? What's the background? What's been your journey?
Well, my background is basically been businesses all my life. I owned my own business for about 25 years, and I was a business banker for a number of years. So I had pretty good exposure on both sides of the ownership issue for businesses. But the last 10 years since starting with as a business broker with yours truly, yep. I gradually morphed over doing business valuations. It seemed to me that there was a need every time a business owner would approach you and say, I want to sell my business. First question out of his mouth was, what do you think it's worth? And I found out pretty quickly that most of the valuation techniques that brokers used or the average layperson used were woefully inadequate. They would give a very, very general price, and very often they'd be way off the mark. But people used them and said this is what the value of the business should be. So since then, I began to get certified through the Institute of Business Appraisers. I did that about 7-8 years ago.
Right.
That was a very lengthy process, but I finally became certified with the CBA certification, which is Certified Business Appraiser. And I've been doing that ever since.
Right. So the intriguing thing that I think that we find as business brokers is the expectation of the owner of the business, that the value of their business. They have an expectation that's worth X number of dollars. And I think that's one of the joys we have as business brokers and as business appraisers is helping them understand that valuation may not be true.
Well, that's one of the biggest problems we have, because business owners almost universally have a very high expectation for the value of their business. And it's kind of my job to bring them down to earth and let them know what it's really worth.
Yep.
Very often the owners are pretty disappointed or depressed by that, but not always. Sometimes they're quite pleasantly surprised that it's worth as much as it is. But
right.
Generally speaking, business owners have a tendency to think a little on the high side.
Yes.
And the business buyers, of course, think a little bit on the low side. Somewhere in the middle. That's where it lives.
Well, that's my experience as well. I did an appraisal about 2 weeks ago for a gentleman, and he thought the business was worth $500,000, and the information I brought to him was worth about $260,000.
Oh, boy.
And his justification was, this is a very specialized business.
Yes.
And I understood what he was saying, that there is some specialty to a certain extent, but the valuation, and we'll talk more about that in a moment, you know, how you put a valuation together, but a valuation is driven by numbers.
It is.
And those numbers are important, because part of the equation when somebody's selling their business is the finance component.
Sure.
And if the finance can't happen because the valuation is too high, then the business won't sell.
Sure.
And that's one of the experiences we have, I'm sure, that trying to explain that to an owner.
Well, your issue on the specialization of a business creating worth, it's fairly common to have a business owner cite that I'm specialized and that's worth something. The specialty or the specialization of a company is typically why the customers came to him.
Right.
But it's not necessarily why a buyer would come to him.
Right.
The buyers have a really wide range of desired businesses they want to buy. So the fact that a company is very, very specialized is not a really high factor in their reason for buying a company. I've seen business buyers who have come in and put in an offer to buy a grocery store, and then the offer never went through, and he subsequently turned around and bought an X-ray technician company.
Right.
So you can see the buyers aren't that specialized.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
That's exactly. That's the intriguing thing, is that buyers have options.
Yes.
And they can compare one business to the other, and the fact that they're in different industries, the buyer's looking for a business that makes sense to their skill set and what they do. It's also making sense to their financial investment and the amount of risk they're willing to take.
Yeah.
So if it's too specialized, that can be a negative, because they're saying, well, if I buy this and then I want to sell it in a few years' time,
yes,
I'm not going to have anyone who wants to buy it. And so I didn't argue with the business seller, because he's thinking about things, but the comment about being specialized,
sure,
got to be careful. It's almost a negative, because it now reducing the pool of buyers that are willing to buy your business. And so if we're not careful, we're going to find it hard to sell, because there's too few buyers that are willing to take that risk of getting into that business.
It is a buyer-driven market, unquestionably. You have to appeal to the buyer and
right.
appeal to their psyche. So basically the valuation models that we do orient toward that.
Right. So we've got a break coming up shortly, and I'll talk to Fred after the break about how we put a valuation together. But one of the intriguing things Fred does, and we'll try and touch on this quickly, is you do different types of valuations for different reasons. So the valuations you do, they're not just for somebody who wants to sell a business. That's one of the types of valuations you do. I think you do different types of valuations for other situations. Give me a couple of examples.
Well, it's kind of a common misconception that a business will have a value, a single value, when in fact a business may have numerous different values depending on the purpose of that appraisal. So there are numerous different reasons why one would have an appraisal on a business. The most common one, of course, is I own the business and I want to sell it. What's it worth? So we do valuations, what we call broker's opinion of value.
Right.
And this is to tell the the owner of the business what he can sell his business for in the open market. But other common methods or evaluations would be for divorce purposes. Divorce purposes used completely different methodologies than, say, we would use for a broker's opinion of value. And it's entirely possible that the valuation for a divorce might come in with a considerably different value than what we would do for the same business if we were talking to an owner who wanted to sell it.
Right.
So the issues on a divorce are that the courts in California only want to use the income approach for the methodology. And the difference in what the courts are willing to accept and what we do for, say, an owner of a business is that the courts say we can't look at future projected earnings, which is the basics for income approach.
Right.
The courts say we can only look at past earnings. We want to give the owner, the spouse owner, a reasonable return on his investment, but we can only look at past earnings. So if you have a company that is growing very rapidly, it's entirely possible that the divorce valuation would be way less than what a willing buyer in the open market be willing to pay for it.
Right.
We also have situations in divorces where professional practices, for example, where we have a CPA or an attorney or a doctor. If the CPA is a single practitioner office, the skill set that owner has that he brings to the table is called personal goodwill. So when we're doing a divorce valuation for, say, a CPA firm, we have to factor out the amount of goodwill that is attributed to the owner's specific skill set and the amount of goodwill that is attributed to the company in general. So we might find here's a company worth $1 million. It has $400,000 worth of hard assets and $600,000 of the goodwill. And we determine that half that goodwill is due to the a skill set, the specific talents of that owner spouse, in which case we would pair off $300,000 to the value of that business, and we would say for divorce purposes, the value of the business is only $700,000 because a third or $300,000 of that is attributed to the owner spouse's expertise.
Fred, I'm going to jump in there. We've got to take a break. Thank you for listening today. You're on 105.5 FM and Money 2.0. I'm your host, Andrew Rogerson, and my guest this morning is Fred Hall. When we come back from break, I've got some more questions for Fred about putting business valuations together, so stay tuned.
Money 2.0 is sponsored by Rogerson Business Services.
Call Money 105.5 at 866-576-1055. And get your questions answered in real time, right now, on Money 2.0.
Control, we can see socks for miles.
I'm sorry, Lunar One, did you say socks?
Miles and miles of socks.
Like we wear on our feet.
Roger, Control, the socks appear to cover the entire dark side of the moon.
In pairs?
No, just random socks and giant fierce mountains of dryer lint.
The search is over! Yeah!
There are some things you can search for and never ever find, but when it comes to finding a local job, SacramentoHelpWanted.com has made the search super easy and free.
Do you see any purple argyle?
Search by keywords or phrases to find hundreds of jobs in accounting, HR, recruiting, retail, or healthcare or IT, and post your resume in minutes.
Lots of tube socks and a... holy cow, there is a river of knee-highs.
I guess the search is over. Check us out. We're SacramentoHelpWanted.com. Long name, amazing results.
Are you sure you don't see any purple argyles?
Are you a business owner or entrepreneur at heart? I am too. I'm Andrew Rogerson, a local business broker and host of Money 2.0. Listen live Tuesdays at 10 on Money 105.5 FM. Let's talk about how you can successfully run your business.
Tune in to Money 2.0 with Andrew Rogerson, certified business broker and author of 4 books, Successfully Start Your Business, Buy Your Business, Buy Your Franchise, and Successfully Sell Your Business. Hear Andrew Rogerson on Money 2.0 live, 10 a.m. Tuesdays, right here on Money 105.5 FM.
Money experts, every morning at 10 on Money 2.0. Now, back to the host, Andrew Rogerson.
Welcome back, and thank you for listening to 105.5 FM and Money 2.0. I'm the host of your show, Andrew Rogerson, and my first guest this morning is Fred Hall. And Fred has a company called Affordable Business Valuations, and that's actually the name of his website. So if you're looking for more information, you're welcome to visit www.affordablebusinessvaluations.com Or if you want, you can give Fred a call. His phone number is 209-256-1371. Fred, before the break, we were talking about different types of valuations. You were mentioning about valuations for a divorce. I also think you do valuations for the IRS, and that sounds pretty intimidating. What are the valuations you do for the IRS?
It can be very intimidating, and one of the things we do every year in our recertification process is to learn all the current court cases that relate to IRS, and it's pretty terrifying what the IRS can do to you and for you. You know, in the case of IRS, though, the issues that we most commonly get used are minority interest valuations. And this is a case where an owner of a business wants to gift shares of his company to his family, his sons and daughters. Also cases where the owner of a company dies. He owns a partial interest in a company, he dies, and the IRS says we want to value that estate. So get involved in estate valuations quite regularly with the IRS, and the minority interest valuations are by far the most complex, basically because – you know, when you look at a company that's, say, worth $1 million,
right,
and I own 33% of that company,
yep,
you would think that, okay, the value of my shares is $333,000.
Right.
Not so.
Right.
If I'm a minority interest holder and I try to sell my shares in the open market, there are no buyers out there that are willing to step up and buy one-third interest.
Right.
Just one of the facts of life. Who wants to buy a company where he has virtually no control over?
Right.
So we look at a company that's worth $1 million, and then we look at a one-third ownership of, say, $333,000, and we apply what we call discounts for lack of marketability and discounts for lack of control. And that company or that share, that one-third interest, may sell on the open market for as little as $200,000, maybe $175,000. There may be as much as 30, 40, 50% discount off the pro rata value of the share is just because it's a minority share interest.
Right.
So there is no one discount that applies to every situation. They're all different. They're all unique. So you'd have a case where I'm a 49% owner and I have one other owner to contend with and he owns 51%. I have zero control. What's my 49% shares worth? Not a lot of money.
Right.
What happens if I'm a 49% owner and the other 51% is distributed amongst five other shareholders?
Right.
I have 49% and they all have 10%. I just need one of those five guys to agree with me and I get everything I want to get.
Right.
My 49% in that case has a tremendous amount of control.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's not going to be as much discount applied to that type of ownership situation.
Right.
Now, we also have cases where I own 4%. And there are two other shareholders. They both own 48%.
Right.
That means one of those two shareholders has to come to me for a majority vote. So my 4% may be worth more on a per share basis than the guy who owns 49%,
right,
who is looking at an owner with 51%
yep.
control. So minority interest valuations are really unique, and they're very specific. Every company is different. But the minority valuation is also dependent upon the purpose of the valuation. In some cases, those discounts for lack of marketability and discounts for lack of control will apply, and sometimes they will not. So we just discussed how IRS is willing to allow us to use those discounts when we're doing estate valuations or gift tax valuations. So the IRS has, over the years, has allowed these types of discounts to be applied to the value of those shares. But now we come back to divorce cases, and the state of California says we will not allow discounts for lack of marketability and control to be applied to the shares of an owner spouse.
Right.
So if an owner spouse owned one-third interest of that $1 million company, for divorce purposes, we would come along and say that he is entitled to $333,000 valuation.
Right.
And that's the amount that would be divided in the marital estate. If that same company were up for an IRS valuation, we would apply those discounts. We might come into a value of $175,000 to $200,000. Same company, two different purposes.
Right.
The difference between those two valuations is huge. We also have shareholder dispute cases, very frequently with minority shareholders involved in it. And in the case of the courts in California have decreed that in the case where there is an owner dispute and a minority shareholder wants to exit the company,
yep,
the courts can rule that the company or the other shareholders have to buy out that minority shareholder. And even though that guy may only own 4%, the courts have said there are going to be no discounts applied to that minority purchase. You have to pay the pro rata full amount of the business.
Right.
So the courts have pretty much moved around our methodologies and whatnot in doing valuations. The courts are very much affect what's happening out there, and it changes. Every new court case that come along, suddenly the rules change.
Yep. So let me jump in. You're talking about minority discounts, and a lot of these minority discount valuations, I think, would show up when you're doing a buy-sell agreement. And so it just talked to me a little bit about the buy-sell agreement, because one of the things I encourage when I'm helping somebody buy a business, if they're going to be a party of two or three or four investors, one of the first things I ask them to do is to put together a buy-sell agreement.
Absolutely.
So there's an agreement on how to get out if there's a health or a death in the group or whatever. There's something, if there's a pressure in the partnership that is forcing one person out,
yep.
Let's have an agreement before we get into that emotional state where the emotions kick in. Let's have an agreement before that happens about how somebody can exit the partnership.
Oh, it's absolutely true, and I, same as you, every time I talk to a group of owners that maybe two or three partners in the company, and I ask if they have a buy-sell agreement, I'm amazed yep. at the number of business owners that say, no, we don't.
Right.
And I look at a buy-sell agreement like a prenup in marriage.
Right.
You know, it's designed to protect all the interests of the individuals.
Yep.
If you don't have that buy-sell agreement in place,
yep.
there's no way that the existing partnership can defend themselves in the event that one partner wants to leave,
right.
or he dies,
yep.
or he goes through a divorce, or he goes through bankruptcy.
Right.
And so it might be a case where you have a 51% partnership and there's two other partners that have the other 49%, and the 51% guy goes through bankruptcy, and he might have to liquidate his shares. If there's no agreement in place as to how he's going to liquidate those shares, the two owners that have 49% might find themselves looking at a new owner in the near future, and they may not like that.
Right.
Chances are they won't like it.
Right.
So the buy-sell agreement is very important, and I actually make a pretty good living off of those companies that don't have buy-sell agreements
right.
because they are forced to come back to me and say, well, now we have to value the business because we have a disgruntled minority shareholder,
yep.
and we have to determine what the value of the business is because the court says we have to pay them out.
Right.
Now, if you had a buy-sell agreement in place, you would forego all those legal problems that typically follow along these minority cases. And the buy-sell agreements should provide that every year the board of directors will put a new value for the business on the table. So at each annual board meeting, one of the topics of the conversation would be, okay, for the upcoming 12-month period, each share of stock that we have is going to be worth $102. So somebody who's going through a divorce or bankruptcy or whatever else and has to tender his shares back to the company, he knows that I'm going to get $102 for it. The alternative is to go through a whole valuation process, go through court process or whatever it takes to be able to determine the value. But if it's in the buy-sell agreement already, you forego all that problem.
So what's your approach when you get these questions from business owners about the buy-sell agreements in place? So your methodology, you're normally looking at three different methods: the asset value, the market value, and the income value.
Exactly.
Just touch on them very quickly because we're running out of time. But I think it's interesting.
Yeah. Those three valuations are the basic groups. There's probably hundreds of potential methodologies as a subset to each of those three.
Right.
But the market approach basically is like what you see for real estate appraisals, comparing your company with all the other companies that have sold. The income approach looks at your company as if it were an investment on the stock exchange. And what is an investor going to demand for a rate of return on this company? And from that rate of return, we can determine the value of the investment. Very complicated process, the income approach is. There's probably, in my valuation, there's probably 2,000 to 3,000 formulas built into that one final
right.
value.
Right.
The asset approach is a very simplified approach. When nothing else works, you look at the asset approach.
And right.
The asset approach says we go to the balance sheet and we just determine the value of each of those individual
yep.
assets.
Yep.
Very simple.
Fred, we're going to wrap it up there.
Great.
I'm glad to have you come on board and talk about business valuations because there's a perception, you know, a business valuation is a fairly simple thing to put together. But as you've shown,
not at all,
and plenty of valuations. So if you're listening, you've got questions about a business valuation, you're welcome to give Fred Hall a call. Fred's number is 209 209- 256-1371, or you can visit his website, www.affordablebusinessvaluations.com. Fred, thanks for being a guest this morning.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
We're heading to break. Thank you for listening to 105.5 FM and Money 2.0. I'm the host of the show, Andrew Rogerson, and we've got Lisa Miller from Ladybug Pest Control when we come back.
Money 2.0 is sponsored by Rogerson Business Services.
Call Money 105.5 at 866-576-1055 and get your questions answered in real time right now on Money 2.0.
Stocks are holding on to their gains. Treasuries are fluctuating. From Bloomberg World Headquarters in New York, I'm Charlie Pellett. Factory orders topped estimates, and the Federal Reserve's William Dudley reiterated that the central bank may prolong bond purchases if needed. Shares of winemaker and alcohol marketer Constellation Brands are slumping 2.4% after earnings missed estimates. Andrew Keene is the president of KeeneOnTheMarket.com.
Yeah, Constellation Brand is not one that really performs that well on earnings. If you look at how it's performed over the last eight quarters, it's actually sold off five of the last eight quarters. So it's not really an earnings story. However, if you look at the chart looks great. It pulled back to that 50-day moving average around 51.20, and then it's popped about a dollar from there.
Shares are down $1.28 to 51.87. Dow Industrials holding on to a 20-point gain at 14,994, up 0.1%. S&P 500 index up 0.2%. And that's a Bloomberg Market Minute.
Financial Market Analysis from Market Wrap host Mo Ansari.
Being right and making money are two different things. Too many people invest their money to be right rather than to make money. Are you more worried about being right, or do you want to make money?
It's helpful financial food for thought on your drive home with a host who tells it like it is. Market Wrap with Mo Ansari.
Don't miss Market Wrap with Mo Ansari weekday afternoons at 5 on Money 105.5.
Thank you for the amazing job you've done in moving my first book forward in the publishing process.
Ludi Cotton Darnell's book, Ashley, Alex, and the Mystery Twins, was published with Zulon Press.
This is an exciting time for me.
Have you got a book for a Christian audience? Want to control the publishing process? Your free publishing guide is at ChristianPublishing.com.
I thank the Lord that Zulon Press has made it possible.
Visit Zulon Press for your free publishing guide at ChristianPublishing.com.
Are you interested in taking investment real estate to the next level? The current opportunity in the commercial real estate market offers investors of all levels fantastic options. Whether you are looking for solid, dependable cash flow or huge potential upside options, call Steve Harper, Managing Director at KW Commercial and host of the Straight Talk Real Estate Hour at 916-798-1116. California DRE Brokers License Number 01267541.
This is Chris Hedrick with Big Valley Mortgage and co-host of Straight Talk Real Estate Hour. With the frequency of changes in loan programs, costs, down payment requirements, and overall credit qualifications, getting a home loan may seem daunting, if not impossible. My commitment to you is to ease this process, communicate throughout the transaction, and above all, give you transparency and assurance. Let me and my team provide you with a first-class service that you deserve. Call me today at 916-969-6537. That's 916-969-6537. Or visit me at my website, bvmhometeam.com. Be a part of the winning team. Join the BVM Home Team for your next purchase or refinance. NMLS 222-374, DRE 01457009.
Are you a business owner or entrepreneur at heart? I am too. I'm Andrew Rogerson, a local business broker and host of Money 2.0. Listen live Tuesdays at 10 on Money 105.5 FM. Let's talk about how you can successfully run your business.
Tune in to Money 2.0 with Andrew Rogerson, certified business broker and author of four books, Successfully Start Your Business, Buy Your Business, Buy Your Franchise, and Successfully Sell Your Business. Hear Andrew Rogerson on Money 2.0 live, 10 a.m. Tuesdays, right here on Money 105.5 FM.
Money experts, every morning at 10 on Money 2.0. Now, back to the host, Andrew Rogerson.
Welcome back, and thank you for listening to 105.5 FM and Money 2.0. I'm the host of the show, Andrew Rogerson, and my second guest this morning is Lisa Miller. And Lisa's tucked away in Arizona, I think. Have I got you there, Lisa?
You got me here, right in Arizona.
Have you melted down there with the heat, or are you, you're okay down there?
Actually, I'm okay. It's been in about 115, 118 degrees lately, but honestly, I don't mind the heat as much as you would think. I'm originally from New York, and I was so sick of the cold, I don't complain about the heat.
Well, you have no way to complain about the heat if you're from New York, because it's just freezing cold in New York. It's a great place to visit New York, but it's also a great place to leave. So you've put together a business, Ladybug Pest Control, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But I'm just interested. Part of the purpose of the show is to encourage people to get into business. So I'm interested. Just give me a little bit of a background. What was your journey of starting out to? I presume you went through college and left and started working. What's just give us a bit of background of your story?
Okay, my story is that honestly, I've always had the entrepreneurial spirit since when I was a child. If somebody had the lemonade stand out, I was going to be one of them. And for whatever reasons, I wanted to have the best lemonade stand, so I would sell more lemonade than any other kids. When I was in high school, I do other small businesses to make sales. I really enjoyed doing whatever I did well. I had this idea that when I got out of high school or college, I would own my own business while I was in college. I do have a college degree, yes. Not specifically in business, though, actually all about people, sociology, history, and psychology, because in my opinion, to do good business, you have to understand people. And so that was really my forte, going and getting connected with people and feeling what it is they're really saying, what they need, and being able to provide whatever it is that they need. So when I got out of, while I was in college, I had two small businesses. I had a small shop, a retail shop that I was running out of a shopping mall, and I had an employee working that for me. It was a very small operation. And when I got out of college, shortly after that, I did move to Arizona. And that was more than, 23, 24 years ago. And when I got here, I was looking for an opportunity. And oddly enough, in the first month or two of living in my house, I was completely overrun with bugs. And so I went to my neighbor and I said, hey, listen, my house is totally infested. I've got bugs everywhere. What's the deal here? And he said, oh, everybody needs pest control here. I get a once-a-month service. Nothing's wrong. It's just normal Arizona. It's so hot here that there are pests everywhere. I said, wow. He said, yeah, I go once a month. Most people here do. So that had the light bulb go off in my head. And I said, wow, what am I going to do here? Let me investigate this possibility. So I actually went out and I got a job for a national pest control company doing pest control, and I started off as a technician. I became a trainer, then I became the manager, and my last position was with them training their managers nationwide to open pest control branches. And honestly, ultimately, their values and my values were very different, and so I wrote a business plan, and in my plan, I wanted to operate a pest control company that was eco-friendly. I wanted something unique because I'm genuinely an earth-friendly kind of gal. And also, I had the concept of franchising as a means to grow my business. And so, again, I started, 1995 is when I opened Ladybug Eco-Friendly Pest Control. And here I am in this day and age selling franchises and doing exactly what I set out to do.
And that's fantastic. So just so I understand, so you left college and you had a retail shop and you were an absentee owner. So you had somebody run that shop for you. I think you mentioned you had a second business. Is that right?
Yeah, I was actually working at a bank. I had completed college. I got several degrees. I was working in a bank as a banker, and then I also had this little side deal for myself. Even when I first moved to Arizona, I saw the need for recycling, and so I began a recycling route in addition to working my pest control job and to see how that would go. And at that time, there was a need for it. And then I also saw that the future of Arizona was a couple of years down the road, they were planning to make recycling part of the trash service. And so at that time, I knew what was coming, and I actually sold my route for the recycling to another company. There was only one other company doing it, and what I thought was going to happen did happen. And a couple of years later, there was no longer that service needed because the city was taking over. So I've always had multiple things going on because I have that interest and that drive to do something that could provide a service and really make money at the same time.
Yep, that's intriguing. I like listening because I'm hearing to be a successful entrepreneur, there's the need to have that personal drive, and that's coming through. To me, it's also interesting that you worked as a banker because I think they teach you great skills. That one of the challenges for a lot of business owners is the finance component or the accounting, the money part of it. And with you having a banking background, that's got to be a great asset for you. And the path to success for a business owner, it can come from many places. And it's just interesting how you've moved through different areas and use those different experiences to make you successful. So I'm hearing in 1995 you opened your first business. Is that right?
Well, I had multiple small businesses along the way, but in 1995 was my first real business that I had a clear plan about what I wanted to do, and it was something that I was sticking with. You know, the other businesses while I was going to college or working other jobs, it was more of an investigation.
Yep.
When I opted to do the pest control business and I started that, I had already had 5 years of experience working for another company, so I know good and well the possibilities for unlimited pest control options and selling service. In most businesses, when you go out, maybe carpet cleaning, you clean the carpet and maybe you get called back in 6 months or a year. With the pest control, when you start someone's service, most people need repeated service, whatever that frequency is. Many people here in Arizona go once a month. We have scorpions and black widows and all kinds of things. In other climates where it's cooler, we do maybe a less frequent service every other month, but it's repeated business. So if in the first month I go out and I get, I don't know, 50 new customers or whatever that number is, and the second month of business, I am still servicing those 50 customers in that month, and then I get 50 more new customers, well, now I have 100 customers. And
right.
In the third month, if I get 50 more, now I have 150 customers. So it grows exponentially, different than many other service businesses, where you get a customer, and then you have to replace that customer because they're not going to repeat with you for some great length of time.
Yep. So you had 5 years of experience in 1995. You opened up Lady Bug Pest Control. And how long before you started to franchise the model? What was the learning curve there to get from 1995 until you started franchising?
Well, I probably have to think back. 7 years ago is when I really started to move this concept forward in the way of franchising in a bigger way. The very first franchise I had was with an employee, and that was many, many years ago. Maybe, I'm stretching my memory now, but... Mm-hmm. 10, 12 years ago,
right.
I wanted to give it a whirl with someone that was already working for me. And in doing that, I could see some of the challenges, I could see some of the benefits. So I'm going to say that, in that case, that was my experiment.
Right.
And we were trying that out to see how it would work. And out of that, I realized different things that were going to make it easy for me to improve my system and do better things for my franchisees.
Right. So it sounds like about 2006 you moved more seriously into franchising. Is that the right way to say it?
Yes, that would be true.
Yep. And so in 2006 you started with zero franchises, or did you had the one operating?
I had a franchise up and running at that time, and that guy was very successful. Actually, I had that franchise and it was sold to someone else.
Okay.
And the new person that came in had capital, had the drive, had the entrepreneurial spirit, had the qualities that I really needed. As I was going along, I realized more specifically what kind of candidate would be good as a franchisee, someone that has that entrepreneurial spirit,
right.
Somebody that has sales ability or has someone on their team with sales ability, someone that will follow direction.
Yep.
Anyone in a franchise system really needs to, on some level, have both worlds, have the entrepreneurial spirit, yet they're getting into a franchise because they're going with a system that has proven success. If they want to invent their own wheel and do it their way, they actually need to go out and do it their way and not get into a franchise. So this person that was the purchaser of that franchise unit really was exceptional at following the system, and now to this day, he is probably one of my most successful, he is my most successful franchisee, and he's really happy for it. You know, he always tells me, I would have never done this if I couldn't get into a franchise, and this whole eco-friendly thing and the direction and the guidance that he has gotten from us in the franchise world is for him, you know, irreplaceable. He said, I'd never been able to be where I am now if I hadn't done what I did with you. So I'm very grateful for that feedback, and he's an exceptional franchisee because he follows the system. He follows my direction.
I love that analogy you're giving. I've written a book. It's called Successfully Buy Your Franchise, and one of the things I try and stress, I offer people the opportunity to buy into a franchise, one of the things I stress is that they do need to follow a system. So the question comes up, are they an entrepreneur? And my buzzword is that they're not really an entrepreneur, they're an intrapreneur. And by being an intrapreneur, they do have entrepreneurial traits, but they do need to follow the franchise system because that's the very thing they're investing in the first place. So
yeah, that's great. That's a great term. Yeah, exactly that. I need somebody with both qualities, but someone with both qualities.
Yep.
Exactly.
If they follow the recipe's been proven. You know how to make it successful. If you follow the recipe, your chances of success are much greater. And that's the value of buying into a franchise because you are buying a proven system. So
exactly,
and that's the benefit of being an entrepreneur. You just follow that system, and life's good.
Mm-hmm.
Lisa,
exactly. Yes, the most successful people in my system are those that follow the system.
Yep. Lisa, we're going to take a break. I've got some questions for you when you come back about the Ladybug Pest Control. But if you're listening, thank you for listening this morning. You're on 105.5 FM and Money 2.0. I'm the host of the show, Andrew Rogerson, and we'll be back shortly.
Money 2.0 is sponsored by Rogerson Business Services.
Call Money 1055 at 866-576-1055 and get your questions answered in real time right now on Money 2.0.
They said it would be so super easy.
Who?
You know, they.
Oh, you met them?
Yes, they.
Hmm. Oh, they, that they.
Yes,
the
yes.
People who say...
Yeah, long name,
amazing results. Yeah, I know.
The SacramentoHelpWanted.com people.
I love them. I posted my resume in minutes, searched hundreds of local jobs.
And you found a job.
Thanks to them, I did.
They.
Ah, I always wondered who they were.
SacramentoHelpWanted.com.
Now I know.
Welcome to Linda's Jobapalooza. I'm Linda.
Wow, this is huge.
57,000 square feet of potential employees. What are you looking for?
Retail.
All the way in the back. Turn left when you hit the IT guys.
Thank you.
We know this is ridiculous, but we're making a point. We're SacramentoHelpWanted.com. And if you're an employer looking for qualified local employees with experience in retail all in one place, don't go here.
There was nobody back there.
Did you turn left at the IT guys?
They weren't there either.
SacramentoHelpWanted.com. Long name, amazing results.
Are you a business owner or entrepreneur at heart? I am too. I'm Andrew Rogerson, a local business broker and host of Money 2.0. Listen live Tuesdays at 10 on Money 105.5 FM. Let's talk about how you can successfully run your business.
Tune in to Money 2.0 with Andrew Rogerson, certified business broker and author of 4 books, Successfully Start Your Business, Buy Your Business, Buy Your Franchise, and Successfully Sell Your Business. Hear Andrew Rogerson on Money 2.0 live 10 a.m. Tuesdays right here on Money 105.5 FM.
Money experts, every morning at 10 on Money 2.0. Now, back to the host, Andrew Rogerson.
Welcome back, and thank you for listening to 105.5 FM and Money 2.0. I'm the host of the show, Andrew Rogerson, and my guest this morning is Lisa Miller. And Lisa's in Arizona, and she has a franchise called Ladybug Pest Control. So we're talking to Lisa about her franchise. Lisa, just give us a bit of background. Ladybug Pest Control, I think it's pretty straightforward, but just talking about the concept, I presume the bugs in Arizona are different to the bugs in California, different to the bugs in New York. Is that fair to say?
The pests are different regionally, yes. But in the southern area, like California, Texas, Arizona, these regions in the southwest have some similar pest activity. And in cooler areas like New York, Northern California, there are different pests in different geographical areas, yet fortunately I've had the experience of when I was with another company, I was training managers nationwide, there were pest control branches everywhere. So although there are different pests, I'm quite familiar with how to treat different pests, what the frequencies are of the what people receive for pest control, and so that it really, bugs are bugs no matter where you are. There may be slightly different methodologies about controlling them or different right. frequencies of service that work better than others. But overall, bugs are bugs, and we're in the business of taking care of people's pest control.
Yep. So the business concept you've got, pest control, it is a U.S.-wide problem. So attracting franchise owners across the U.S. fits in very nicely with your business model.
Exactly. And our uniqueness is that we do eco-friendly pest control, and it's genuine. We offer an organic pest control service, and that is something that's on the top of many people's minds these days. First thing when people call in, is it safe for my kids? Is it safe for my dogs? We have tremendous referral partners in this day and age. Veterinarians are tremendous for us, naturopath doctors, anyone that's ever suffered from any kind of ailment, autoimmune disorder, cancer, anything like that, they're all of a sudden a heightened awareness about chemicals and exposure to chemicals. And when I first began back in 1995, I would say, hey, good news, I'm eco-friendly, and 9 out of 10 people say, well, we don't care, lady, just kill the bugs.
Right.
Good news is I'm just killing the bugs. I'm not killing you or the pets or the kids, just the bugs. And so now it's really the intersection of timing that the awareness is so much greater for this. And, again, the referral partners are endless. We do so many schools. We do nursery schools, endless apartment complexes, office buildings where they have liability for people being allergic to the chemicals or have had problems in the past. The referral partner list is amazing for us to network with to really get customers on a monthly basis, just adding and adding and adding and have the business grow.
And when you say you're eco-friendly, is there a way you're able to make that claim? Like, is there something that you've done to it's just a matter of using the right chemicals, or is it a little bit deeper than that?
Well, what we're using are products that are National Organic Program compliant. That's NOP compliant, which means that they are certified organic. Although we are eco-friendly, we cannot use some homemade mixture from the backyard, like tea tree oil or water. I don't know what it could be, but we don't have the capacity to do that. We're a professional pest control company, so we must use products that are EPA-approved or FDA-approved. Some of our products literally are FDA-approved, meaning they're edible. Not that I'm going to go out and eat the pest control, but that is the category they fit in because they're so safe. A lot of it repels bugs. Many of our products just flat-out kill them when they cross the barrier. And I've been providing this service for many, many years. When
right.
I began in 1995, there might have only been several products available to me that were considered eco-friendly, and so that was all I had in my arsenal of tools to really work with. So I relied on being super, super thorough to eliminate people's pest problems. Now, yes, we're still super, super thorough. It's just that, my menu is now increased to 30, 40, 50 different products that I could potentially use at a customer's home that are compliant. And when I say National Organic Program compliant, there are many companies. We do businesses, for instance, that are what's called LEED certified, Leadership
yep.
Excellence in Environmental Development, and they must be compliant, and what we're using fulfills that for them. So we're genuinely providing eco-friendly service.
And the market you're servicing, are you mainly servicing residential properties, or do you move out of the residentials?
We do primarily residential with this particular franchise opportunity. If we were to do commercial, I say it's light commercial, meaning storage units, office buildings during the hours of Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 or something like that. With this particular business opportunity and with Ladybug Franchise, part of our claim is that it's a lifestyle business. It's Monday to Friday. You can close the doors at 5 o'clock. We don't have our technicians working late nights or evenings or weekends, and that's kind of standard in the pest control industry, particularly when you're doing commercial work. A lot of times you have to go to hotels and restaurants, and that has to be at like midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
So we focus on target customers that historically are residential or what I'll call light commercial and can be done during normal standard business hours Monday to Friday. We also have a commercial business opportunity available, and typically that's going to just be one commercial branch in each area, not like in a metropolitan area. One commercial branch would handle it all, different than having multiple units
right.
of residential franchising.
Yep. So we're talking about the a good franchise buyer or a good entrepreneur to come and buy a Ladybug Pest Control franchise. What's an ideal candidate that you're looking for to bring on as part of your franchise system?
Well, we have two different levels of franchising. We have the regional development franchisee, and that person would be someone that would buy, California is really large, so there are, I think, three regional development territories available, the southern part, the mid part of the state, and the northern part of the state.
Right.
Then there's the unit owner, which would be more like a city, not the state. And so the regional development territory person should be someone that really has the entrepreneurial spirit, can follow the system, but is a real leader. That person will have to ultimately sell franchises, and then support those franchisees. Everyone that ever buys a franchise comes through the corporate headquarters training in Arizona, and then they go to their designated territory and start working their area. With the regional development people, they are there specifically to support the unit owners after they've gone through the program at the corporate office to help them launch their brand. The regional development territory person is also going to be running and operating their own unit. It's going to be like the training site or the site for them to be able to show other franchisees how it's done, and it's also a way for them to generate income. The regional development territory guy will generate income by running his own pest control business, number one. Number two, they get 50% of the franchise fees and 50% of the royalty fees that are designated for unit owners, and so that's another stream of revenue. And the last way they can also make money is that when a regional development territory person goes into an area, they have one unit, let's say a city. But because there may not be any other franchisees in their area yet, they have the capacity to go beyond their boundaries, because it's only on paper in the beginning when there are no other unit owners, and develop their border areas. And so my suggestion is always for a regional developer person to go out, do their city, but then go to the border cities and develop them, and then sell that unit to a franchisee with existing customers, so that franchisee is then up and running with almost literally a full business before they're even getting going. So they have a steady income, the royalty stream will be there for the regional development person, and ideally they're going to make a lot of money on that day. They could sell a route for, you know, whatever they've developed in that area. They could have developed a customer's worth whatever they generate in a year. So, you know, if there's 100 customers there, maybe it could be $50,000. If there's 200 customers there, it could be $100,000. You know, the number can be exponential for what a regional development person can sell those customers for if they've developed the whole route. You know, if there's a few hundred customers there, that can be a route, and that could be a lot of money on that payday for that person.
Lisa, I'm going to jump in because time's against us, but just very quickly, what's the cost for a regional developer to invest? Just very quickly.
It depends on the territory, and so it could be anywhere between $115,000 to $250,000, depending on the area, because you're allowed to open a certain amount of units. The minimum would be about 30 units, and some areas are up to 40 or 50 units they could open in that area, and a unit is for $30,000.
Lisa, thanks for being a guest today. I've got to wrap it there. Thank you for listening to the guests, to the listeners. Thank you for listening. You're on 105.5 FM and Money 2.0. We'll talk to you next Tuesday at 10 o'clock. Are you a business owner or entrepreneur at heart? I am too. I'm Andrew Rogerson, a local business broker and host of Money 2.0. Listen live Tuesdays at 10 on Money 105.5 FM. Let's talk about how you can successfully run your business.
Tune in to Money 2.0 with Andrew Rogerson, certified business broker and author of 4 books, Successfully Start Your Business, Buy Your Business, Buy Your Franchise, and Successfully Sell Your Business. Hear Andrew Rogerson on Money 2.0 live, 10 a.m. Tuesdays, right here on Money 105.5 FM.